This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Montagne. When it comes to trust in government, young people stand out. Public opinion polls show they have more faith and less anger than their elders. NPR's Tobias Smith looks at whether it's just the innocence of youth or something deeper that this generation may carry with them.
A generation ago, they vowed never to trust anyone over 30. But as it turns out, those under 30 today are actually the most trusting of all.
As of now, I trust the government. I feel like they are trying to do what is best for us and for their constituents.
Brittany Tucker is a poli-sci major at Northeastern University who believes in her government. The percent of young people who agree with her is significantly higher than older people, though it's worth noting it's still only about a third of the younger set who say they trust government all or most of the time, and it's often with caveats. As another poli-sci major, Jennifer Krall, puts it, everything's relative.
I definitely think that politicians are given a really bad rap. There are certainly plenty of CEOs and executives out there that are just as bad, and that we certainly shouldn't be pointing the fingers simply because they're politicians.
We'll start with the office of president. Are there any nominations for the office of president?
I nominate Brittany Tucker.
Both Krall and Tucker made their first foray last week into what they still see as the noble pursuit of politics, running for office in their college Democrats club.
All those in favor of electing Brittany Tucker, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. Congratulations, Ms. Tucker.
Like so many of her peers, Tucker was inspired to get into politics by the campaign of Barack Obama.
What essentially sets a nation state apart, which is the monopoly on violence.
It gives you hope, and that hope, turns into trust in the government because you believe that, things can change or, good things can happen.
Analysts say that Obama love may be what's propping up young people's trust. Most under 30s supported Obama in 2008 and still do today, but that doesn't explain everything. Even young Republicans who believe the best government is less government are also more trusting than their elders. Jay Altshuler, a member of Northeastern's College Republicans, says it's basically blissful ignorance.
We haven't had a lot of experience with government for the most part.
Attitudes will change, as one expert put it, when young people grow up and get mugged by reality. Altshuler and fellow GOP student Michael Sabo agree.
The second they get a paycheck and they see what comes out of it,
I think we're all about to learn the hard way.
I think we all are.
If history is any guide, they may be right. Polls going back to 1958 show that trust always begins to head south sometime after age 30. But there are some clues that this generation may be different.
The millennials are quite positive towards other big institutions like corporations and the military and faith. So it does give you a feeling that it's a different generation.
Tufts University researcher Peter Levine says young people today are not angry or alienated like previous generations were.
They don't define themselves in terms of opposition or trying to smash everything. They don't have a generation gap, really. They really cite their parents as role models and as political guides. The current thing is you call your mom on your cell phone to find out what she thinks, which I really don't think was a 60s attitude.
Indeed, it may be why young people today are largely not swayed by the Tea Party. Mention the Tea Party and they're likely to either scoff or shrug.
What do you mean about the Tea Party?
The Boston Tea Party?
Like Northeastern seniors Will Ducombe and Jen Trost, nearly half of young people say they don't follow politics.
I figured I'll work on that as I get older. I don't really follow it at all. Just been studying.
Yeah, I just care about my finals.
It's a pretty good bet that these young people will begin to care more as they start looking for work in coming years, and their feelings for government may hinge on the economy. If the recession ends sooner, young people may give the government the credit and their eternal trust. But if the economic downturn persists, their positive attitudes most likely will not. Tobias Smith, NPR News.
Escape from Imagination Land, Part 3 of 3, the most successful criminal gang in history. Critical thinking question, which I think I just answered. What is the real purpose of government?
Yeah, you know it. Just can't help yourself, yeah. Ain't the best model there.
My favorite
has to be, you know, the opening scene of the first Godfather, where, you know, the caretaker comes in and, you know, Marlon Brando's sitting there and he's saying, "You disrespected me, you know, now you want a favor." That's the tone for the whole movie.
Then all hell breaks loose, right?
Right. I mean, there's that combination of old world gentility and, you know, ritual with this savagery underneath it. And it's all about family. It's a great movie.
Ah, romanticizing violence. Such a popular pastime for movie enthusiasts, college students, citizens, and, of course, U.S. presidents and other world leaders. But why so popular? Today, Wes Bertrand and I will continue our exploration of that question. We'll pick up right where we left off. Thanks for listening.
One book I was going to mention on an intellectual level that I think everyone should check out is For the New Intellectual by Ayn Rand. And it's a compilation of all of the philosophical excerpts in her novels. Various characters in her novels went on all kinds of philosophical paths and explained all kinds of things that are really insightful. You know, Galt's speech is in there, for example. Who is John Galt, by the way? And at the beginning of the book, I think it's about 60 or so pages, she discusses this thing about Attila and the Witch Doctor, how faith and force, or force and faith, have gone together to subvert the mind of human beings and to have power over them and to enslave them. So the force can only be used when people are hoodwinked through mythology, that it's actually good for them, that it's virtuous, and all those things that the witch doctor does to convince people that poison is actually good for them. And then, of course, the witch doctor relies on Attila, the person wielding the club, exerting the force, to follow through on that, to do the dirty work, and to basically subjugate human beings. So it's a fascinating dynamic that's gone throughout history, and it still exists presently. So that's a good book to check out. And one other thing I was going to mention, if people really want to know more about the psychology of all these things, I have a really good source of resources on my psychology meetup group page in San Diego. So I can throw the link to you, Brad, if you want to put those in the show
Absolutely.
Notes, because it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, and I think this pairing of faith and force that has just continually, suppressed and repressed humanity in so many ways for so long, I think so many people fail to see the context of the world in which they live, that those have always been these two incredibly powerful forces. I was listening to the show you did this morning about NPR did this study, or they were reporting on a study of these students and saying that this generation of young people who are in college now have an increasing faith in government. Mm-hmm. And I found that astounding and very upsetting. I was kind of hoping that we were moving away from that. And earlier we talked about, you know, I think that people have these desires that they want to be good and they want to feel efficacious. And we certainly see how that can land confused people in politics or even in political participation. But I think that something else that is pretty consistent is that people want to feel as if somebody, now this takes us back to the beginning of recorded history again, they want to feel like somebody is there looking out for them, watching over them, and caring about them. Now, I think
somebody's in charge.
Right. Now, of course, this was, you know, for so long, God the Father, and then obviously a bunch of, other gods and demigods and kings. And it's really manifest in our present society in two types of authoritarianism. We have, of course, the maternal authoritarianism of, you know, the sort of liberal hand up, hand out, we'll take care of you.
Nanny state.
Nanny state, exactly. And then we have the paternal authoritarianism of, you know, we'll keep you safe, we'll go get the bad guys.
Nobody gets out of line, law and order, all that good
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly, exactly. And people are very, very comfortable with that. But as we're talking about, you know, the lack of context, I thought about trying to have a conversation with these girls who were interviewed by NPR and asking them the question, you know, as I, this might be a little bit too much begging the question or leading the witness, as we might say in court. In an earlier show, I had a critical thinking question, explain the difference between the government and organized crime. But I think a less way to load that question up with conclusions would be to say, what do you think the real role of government is? And so we've explored this imagination land and all of these fantasies that we're hopefully coming out of. But I think this is going to be one of the most difficult and powerful non-personal level illusions for most people to break. The historic role of government has been an organization, large or small, that forcefully transfers resources from one group either to the government or to people connected to the government. We have this fantasy in this country that 230 years ago, when a bunch of slave owners and aristocrats and hypocrites wrote some stuff down on paper, that's a pretty good word.
Hypocritical aristocrats.
But that they wrote some stuff down on paper, and suddenly this violent and vicious and dangerous organization that had always just been about imperial conquest and slavery and subjugation suddenly became virtuous somehow.
Mm-hmm. And it's somehow front and center in our lifestyle, in our lives. It's socially sanctioned. It's the foregone conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you could actually get a hold of these two ladies, because one, they reported that she won the election for the student government that they have going on as part of the Democratic wing in their university or something. Yeah. So maybe you can get a hold of her. That'd be a fascinating interview.
I think it would be too. And as I was listening to, I rang your phone 5 minutes after that segment of your podcast this morning, as I was listening to it in my car. And my initial idea was, Wes, we should try and interview this girl together. But I think for a liberal college student, that would be quite overwhelming. So
it might be. One of us might have to take her side just to make it fair.
Well, so what I figured would make more sense is for, and I'll put the clip at the beginning of this show too, but I figured it would make more sense for maybe me to invite her and invite her friend. It's just, how willing are they going to be to come on a show called School Sucks when their whole education probably seems like it's being subsidized by the government right now? And they're probably really grateful for that, not realizing the long-term implications or not realizing why that's a significant reason why they're probably paying $40,000 for tuition. That's, you know, accruing interest right now either. Like, those are government-created problems. I'd be interested in exploring that with them. But, you know, that question of what is the real role of government? Really, really, I mean, people don't want to have that conversation. That is the super anxiety attack conversation.
And there's even a prior question there, like, what is the definition of government? How do you define government?
Right, exactly. And, I mean, can I tell you something? I can't believe I've never mentioned this on the show before. I was tutoring a student last year, and he had to take a U.S. government class at his government school. And I did kind of, even though that's not the focus of my job, to persuade people into my political or philosophical point of view, I did mention that there is kind of a conflict of interest in learning about the government from the government, right? Like, you know, if a McDonald's hired an ad agency and they came back with, like, television spots extolling the virtues of cooking at home and eating salads and, you know, having a low-sodium diet, they'd probably be like, wow, you know, that's not exactly what we were looking for there. We want some dancing and, you know, some clowns. And, you know, that's really
– exactly.
That's kind of what we're shooting for. So he did understand that. But I picked up the government book and just sort of in, you know, my own dark curiosity, I went to the glossary to see what the definition of government was in the government textbook from the government school. The definition, the official definition of government, according to this book, is simply the legitimate use of force.
Interesting.
Nothing else. And no debate. Not the legitimate use of force, which is legitimate because. It's just kind of, that's yes. what the glossary says, the legitimate use of force.
Yes, don't question, little citizen. This is legitimate, whether you like it or not.
So how does it become legitimate? That's the mystery. What do you think?
Because they said so, right? The judge says so. The politicians say so. The police officer says so. It's all legitimate because they say so. There's no reasoning involved other than, you know, sort of reference to the population, like the majority of people or the plurality or, who, you know, all that sort of collectivistic stuff. But in terms of actual rational understanding, no, it's completely absent, isn't it?
So I guess the best that we can take out of that or the most authentic rationalization in that bunch would be that it's sanctioned by majority or it's accepted by the majority.
Supposedly.
Well,
right?
I guess then that would, if the principle is that force is legitimate, if the majority of people approves of it, just hypothetically, and this would be highly unlikely, explain the difference between government and organized crime. If there was a neighborhood controlled by the mafia, let's say, and they were able to go around and through some kind of suggestion box or signature process, get 51% of the people in the neighborhood to consent to their activities, does racketeering and hits and extortion become legitimate if that's the principle? And this is where people really think that I suck. When we bring things like that up and we say, okay, let's get to a principle. Let's get to some underlying principle that makes all this make sense. That's the Minesweeper game, really, right there.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the evidence is actually on the side of reason and reality here in terms of this whole socially sanctioned, legitimate thing. I'm sure the guys in Free Talk Live are going to see this one because I know Ian subscribes to the Liberator Online, published by the Advocates for Self-Government. Their latest issue, they had a story here, a news item that says, this is under the Good News, Bad News, Unbelievable News by James Harris, the editor. Only 23% say U.S. government has, quote, consent of the governed. The Declaration of Independence famously proclaims that governments derive, quote, their just powers from the consent of the governed, unquote. On July 12th to 13th, respected pollsters Rasmussen reports decided to see if that consent actually exists. They asked 1,000 likely voters this question. The Declaration of Independence says that governments derive their authority from the consent of the governed. Does the federal government today have the consent of the governed? The results were revolutionary. Reports Rasmussen, just 23% of voters nationwide believe the federal government today has the consent of the governed. 62% say it does not, and 15% are not sure. These figures are almost identical to the responses to the same question last February. In his recent book, In Search of Self-Governance, pollster Scott Rasmussen observes that the American people are, quote, united in the belief that our political system is broken, that politicians are corrupt, and that neither major political party has the answers, unquote. He adds that, quote, the gap between Americans who want to govern themselves and the politicians who want to rule over them may be as big today as the gap between the colonies and England during the 18th century, unquote. The Declaration of Independence follows the phrase about consent of the governed with these words, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
Yeah, but don't we have like a social contract where if we live here, we're kind of, according to the contract, which honestly I've never seen, but...
yeah, who wrote up the contract?
That's a good... I've never seen a copy of one.
No, it's just implicit, right? It's implied. By virtue of being on a certain geographical plot of land, you are consenting, apparently.
Yes, and I think that the contract becomes binding when you exit the birth canal on that plot of land. And I'm like, I'm certainly grateful that like my cell phone service or my cable service doesn't work the same way. But because I don't think it would be very good quality if, you know, I was entered into it the moment I was born. I think people might sooner or later start to take advantage of that. But, yeah, I think that that's a little bit strange. There are no other contracts that work that way. No one has ever been able to produce a copy or explain themselves putting their signature on one. So it seems kind of mythical to me.
Just collectivistic smoke and mirrors, plain and simple. And as I mentioned in this last podcast, they have no property rights jurisdiction, right? They've not contracted as an agent to property owners to protect and serve people, right? To defend individual rights or anything like that. It's completely arbitrary. It's saying, we presume to govern you and we'll give you this suggestion box every 4 years or whenever. You can vote various people and put various hood ornaments on these cars that are careening off the cliff. But in terms of the cars themselves, I mean, we're in charge of that. So.
Well, I think, yeah. And then, you know, so we did the Xanax, which is the majority of majority consent makes it legitimate. We mm-hmm. washed it down with some liquor. That is the social contract. And we finish it off with, I don't know, OxyContin of, if we don't have this organization, people are going to come and kill us, which is kind of like where we've gotten to. Like, listen, all right, fine. We're not here for you. We're not, you know, we're not doing your will, whatever. But we do have this vested interest in stopping boogeymen from killing you. So that's mm-hmm. really just kind of you want us around. And the earth's
supposedly.
And the earth's going to flood.
Yeah. And, of course, this poll didn't really question people on local governments either, state, county, and city. I mean, they don't really have the consent of the governed either because, in most cases, a very small percentage of the population votes for this person that won, right? Mm-hmm. So usually less than a majority are determining the fate of everyone else in terms of how they're being ruled over by certain people. And, of course, if you vote and you lose, the person that you wanted in doesn't get in. By voting, you're basically saying, I agree to the terms of this, because if I win in my voting process, then I want everybody to abide by that leader, right? So-called leader. But if I lose, I guess I've got to, you know, eat some crow and just take it in the shorts here and wait for my next chance to pull that lever and hopefully get my personal bailout or, you know, punish my enemies and reward my friends and so forth. So the whole process is set up to distract people from what really matters, which is individualism and making their own choices with their own property and dispelling this myth of public property, which just ropes us into the tribal premise, right?
Yeah. So it's almost like people... Gosh, you know, I mean, it's such a loaded, presumptuous question, but what is the difference between government and organized crime?
I think the average person would say, well, government is socially sanctioned, which what does that mean? Socially, what is society, if not just individuals? And what sort of thoughts are in each individual's head that is granting legitimacy to the power structures presently, you know, and why do those people, those individuals attack other individuals that challenge the notion that this organization called government is in any way legitimate? You know, why would they aid and abet an organization that's actually destroying or denigrating their lives rather than benefiting them? Unless, of course, they're on the dole. And of course, as government gets bigger and more people, you know, get that sort of parasitical relationship with government, and it makes it even harder to see the truth or to want to see the truth, to really introspect and to understand one's emotions in this process, to achieve clarity so that you're actually aligned with reality and with truth once again, and you're courageously defending that truth. As you noted with Steph on that one podcast talking about heroism, that's really the true nature of it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's it feels at the beginning like there's there's quite a few liabilities and risks in doing that. And I kind of in a recent show felt like I painted this picture of myself as, oh, I started telling people the truth and everybody went away and then I was all alone. But, the truth is that you kind of realize that most of the people that, or in my case anyway, most of the people that I was surrounded by, I wasn't interested in continuing relationships with. Because as soon as you do that kind of friendship test of, this is something that's very important to me, what are your feelings about this? People do kind of scatter, but you also know that's going to happen. I know you've lived here, Wes, in New Hampshire before, but up here in New England, people talk about the Sox and the Pats and the weather, and there is some kind of regional obsession with weather here, just because it changes. So, I know you probably didn't experience this in San Diego. But, just because it changes so rapidly and so dramatically, it is something that, people are constantly preoccupied with. And, we have
this continual battle with nature.
Yeah.
Right?
And we have this, you can watch people do this, and it gets really frustrating just how people's comfort level with conversations that are completely inane and in this sort of 1-2-3, 1-2-3 safety waltz of conversations. The weather,
great metaphor.
The weather is always step one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Then you grab their hand, put your hand around their waist.
Yeah, exactly. But
cue the music.
That got really frustrating, and it was really hard to see that that's what most of my relationships were. And before I realized that, I was so happy for so long and so anxious to point out the slave dialect that most people speak in their political lives, where they would look at aggression, funded by aggression, that leads to more aggression, and they would call it protection or defense. That's like slave language. But yes. I think a lot of us in our own lives, and I can certainly speak from experience, I had a lot of things that were objectively called, should have been called anyway, unwanted obligations that I referred to as commitments or friendships or relationships. Mm. And that just wasn't the case. And, the weather thing really just the weather and the Red Sox and the just inane nature of conversations really started to get to me to a point where I was frustrated by my surroundings. And I almost kind of like half jokingly tried to devise offensive and confrontational ways to discuss the weather with people, which I don't recommend actually, putting that into these conversations. But I think it might warm people up to some political confrontation if they were like, oh boy, hot today, I'm sweating, and you're like, yeah, you ungrateful asshole, don't you know that there's people on this planet who don't even see the sun for 6 months and you're complaining about being
exactly
92 degrees? What's wrong with you?
They can't enjoy, slipping on the ice and busting their ass.
Yeah. You could really warm somebody up people have all of these defense mechanisms too that I mentioned in shows past, where things will start to heat up and people will just jump to, well, everybody's entitled to their opinion.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that yep. will, everything turns relative all of a sudden.
Yep, that. So, boy, wow, we almost had a conversation, but you stopped it in its tracks.
Yeah,
and I got really tired of that, and I don't think I consciously made a choice that what I'm doing is something that I would consider heroic. And if you remember in that show, when Steph asked me about it, I almost snapped back to like this earlier point in my life where it's hard to even answer a question like that. Like, if you just think about our training, it was like something left over in me was like apprehensive about answering the question of why I think that the things that I'm involved in or the things that I've done personally could even be classified as heroic. Like, I think I balked at answering that question. And people shouldn't be afraid to do that. you know, I was so pissed at Mark Edge, for who I really like, and I think he's obviously essential to the whole Free Talk Live on-air dynamic. But I was really frustrated a couple weeks ago where he was talking about almost being ashamed in Keene of being a Free Stater. And like, well, that's not something I would say. And I kept saying, oh, boy, I should call and confront him on that. But
I think Meg did a pretty good job.
I think she did as well. But just to call and say, hey, you know, even mainstream history, the people who speak up and say this is wrong and this is what justice means and this is what truth is, even mainstream history eventually can't ignore most of those people as heroic. So why don't you just kind of try to live into it now, right, instead of being ashamed while, you know, you wait for history to eventually judge what you're doing. I mean, Free Talk Live I know those guys work really hard, but the fact that they're on 80 radio stations is a miracle. You know, it is a miracle of libertarianism that they've been, not to take away from any of the hard work that they do, but that is like astonishing. And
yeah, I think it's really
the amount of people that they've reached, like just Mark, you know, say what you are and live into that heroism now. Don't be ashamed of it, because one day, if all goes well, you will be anyway. So maybe you can enjoy it instead of, you know, just 50 years after you die, other people regarding you that way.
Yeah, I think one part of the heroic process is turning that upside down morality back right side up, because there is this tendency to start feeling that, oh, maybe I'm the crazy one because I'm advocating all these extremist radical ideas and everyone else seems to be, you know, status quo, no problem. But in fact, those people are the crazy ones. At least they have crazy ideas, you know, to not engage in ad hominem. They're not thinking in a way that's clearly aligned with the truth. They're not thinking in terms of reason and reality. And that's part of the heroic process, to actually save your life, because it matters that much. It is invaluable to be aligned with reason and reality. Reality is our closest friend and safeguard, as I noted in my first book, The Psychology of Liberty. Because once we start doing that, once we start aligning with the truth, then greater things can happen for us. We can meet new and interesting people that are also that way and encourage us to do the same, right? That don't have difficulties articulating emotions and conveying things in empathetic ways and understanding ways. I mean, all that is just win-win stuff. It's how we become more and more real. And that's what we really need a big dose of in today's reality with other people. So I think it's really important to basically turn the tables and say, listen, I'm advocating peace and voluntary interaction and respect for individuals. And the ideas that you're promoting and advocating are the exact opposite. And that's not right. That's not good.
Unfortunately, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I really am glad, and I, you know, I feel proud to be, you know, a part of a movement that is trying to do that approach. Unfortunately, it's such unsafe territory for so many people that it's almost like, how do you strategize? And, you know, I really, like I said, this interplay between the personal and the political and really kind of getting to the behind the scenes stuff with people. I mean, you have to be genuine and you have to try it. Like any discussion that you have with people, it's not a contest to see who knows more facts. You really have to try and communicate with them on a personal and authentic level and say, what are you feeling? What is going on for you here when I bring these things up? And not, you know, if people can do nothing but put up deflections where they go to the Red Sox and they go to the weather, when you try to explore these things, that's just move on. You know, move on.
Yeah.
And that was when I used to call obligations commitments. It was hard to move on. It was hard to move on. It was hard to say, well, this is just not a good place for me. This is not a good interaction, and this is not a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think,
and where do you think the difficulty, the hardness of moving on came from? Was it just that sort of guilt that you would feel for kind of distancing from someone that you've been connected with, that you're somehow betraying a relationship or something?
It's comfort. Yeah, absolutely. And it's managing anxiety.
And you're not rocking the boat.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I've seen and witnessed, you know, maybe I've never been in anything in my personal life that I would consider just like an abusive, destructive relationship from hell. But I have seen them, and these people just stay and stay. I was talking to this guy today who's been married for 20 years, and it was just went on for, you know, half an hour about how miserable he was. You know, oh, but there's kids. Oh, well, I bet they're really enjoying that. You know, that comfort level, I think, is just so – or that need for comfort is just so pervasive that people don't even realize, personal, political, wherever – how destructive what they're subjecting themselves to really is. You know, it's funny. Yeah, we started here talking on this little subject, the difference between government and organized crime. I remember following the story of a mobster, probably the most famous real-life mobster ever, John Gotti. Mm-hmm. You know, the people in his neighborhood, by the fact that he lived there, that the Gambino crime family operated there, it put all of their lives in more jeopardy, their children's lives in more jeopardy. It destabilized commerce. Businesses were getting extorted. But every time that John Gotti would beat a court case, the witness would suddenly forget or something like that. They would celebrate in the neighborhood. They would set off fireworks. They would come to parties, and they would just all rejoice that John wasn't going to jail, that the Gambino family was still going to be there. When they finally took John Gotti down, a rival gang led by Rudolph Giuliani eventually helped in that process, the people in the neighborhood were just outraged, and they thought it was a disgrace. They thought this was this horrendous crime that had been perpetrated against them. Mm-hmm. And it was like, if you just scale that up, everything is normal. We're happy to have this thing here that ruins our economy and puts us in more danger. We need that thing here. But when you scale it down to, you know, the Gambino crime family in some Queens neighborhood, suddenly the insanity of that is revealed.
Yeah, it just comes across as so perverse.
Yeah. People want to feel like somebody's there looking out for them.
It is a form of addiction, is it not? They're wrapping their identity up in this really false idea or just orientation towards another person or their behavior. It's not based on really authentic self-esteem. It's not individualistic. It's not reason and reality based. And keep coming back to that, because that's the crux of it, this objectivity that we need to really ensure our survival and ensure our flourishing, because at the bare minimum, we need to survive, and then we need to flourish as rational beings. And how do we go about doing that when we've got this giant lead weight called government dragging us down, and all of these obligations that you point to and personal relationships dragging us down and preventing us from being aligned with what we really want, what's good for us?
And most importantly, the individuals calling themselves government, unless I don't have a sticker right or a permission slip handy, I don't get much trouble from them. The real problem, you know, I think that we explored today, in addition to the horizontal attacks that we get from people who are also subjected to the same system.
Our fellow political slaves,
yeah.
Right?
And another one that I really realized today, you know, I spend all this time on the show talking about the state and talking about the evils of the education system. It's kind of ironic that all of this violence, all of this aggression, all of this predation actually has a powerful accomplice, and that is the imaginations of ordinary people. Right, and I'm not just talking about, you know, the perpetuation of fear, but this imagination land that people use to manage their anxiety about whatever they care about, or the lack of goodness, the lack of genuine goodness or morality or efficacy that they feel in their own lives. They're just going to imagine that the government, you know, the most successful gang in history is going to take care, is there to take care of that stuff for them. And like, that's a really important conversation to have with people as well. That's not what the government is for. That's not, I mean, of course, as time went on, they had to, and people did become more enlightened, and science replaced mythology. Yeah, they had to come up with more clever rationalizations for it. But this thing is not about helping people. There might be some ancillary benefits here and there. There might be some smooth surfaces to drive your car on, but that wasn't the goal. That's not the purpose. Stop pretending that it is.
Yeah, those are just incidental things, and it's overlooking all of the unseen costs, right? And that's one thing that even libertarians need to grasp. How much better our lives would be without this widespread coercion, with all this control of other people's choices and property.
Right.
I mean, it's incalculable. It's hard to even imagine how it would be, because you've got millions and millions of people that would be making all kinds of really great creative decisions based on respectful interaction with other people.
Yeah.
And we just see a little sliver of that now. And people hold on to that sliver, and then they credit the very entity that it's just relegated to a sliver called government. Yeah.
How much better would life in Queens be in the 1980s without the Gambino crime family? Well, what about
exactly.
What about the fireworks displays and the free sausages and peppers? You know?
Yeah. Well, you could have those and a whole lot more stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Without any of the negatives. It's all the positives without the negatives.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just not visible yet. So as we move out of this age of pre-logic, as we move out of this imaginary world, I'm certainly hopeful for the future. And I know it will take time, and there's many aspects to the emergence of a free world, of a society of complete liberty. It's exciting to be alive at like the right time for this stuff to start happening, I think. It's very exciting.
It really is, yeah. I just got done downloading a whole lot of podcasts, as a matter of fact, which I ran into on KurzweilAI.net newsletter called Fast Forward. These guys are talking about futurism. And it looks like a whole bunch of cool, positive, optimistic, fascinating things about what's in store for us. And as I wrote in Complete Liberty, you know, imagine a future world of complete liberty and all these sort of scientific engineering feats that can happen, that actually will happen. And they'll happen a lot faster if we have more and more liberty. So that's what makes this all so much more important. And as far as your younger audience goes, really, you might be some of the first people on the planet to have indefinite lifespans if we play our cards right. So that's something to think about, too.
Absolutely.
Raises lots of philosophical, moral questions. But it's like, this is really, really important. We have a window of time here, and let's maximize it.
And we, you know, we covered this subject before, you and I, actually, on my show, when we were talking about how to break free of the conformity and the collectivism and pursuing individualism. Imagine the free world that leads to breaking out of that. I remember Ray Kurzweil saying one time, I can only really paraphrase him, but like, exponential growth seems like nothing is happening. And I think a lot of people who are getting into this pursuit of liberty feel that way, and they get frustrated. And a lot of people got all ramped up about, you know, Ron Paul, and then they just kind of crashed. Exponential growth seems like nothing's happening, and then a bunch of stuff happens seemingly all at once, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and when more people get aligned with the truth and not go on these side roads to dead ends, all these distractions, for example, playing politics, get involved in the political machinations, but actually are aligned with truth and bring that discussion to people in their personal lives and then in the culture at large, I think there's going to be a serious tipping point that's going to happen, and it's hard to predict when it's going to happen.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm driving at.
Yeah.
So before we wrap up, first of all, Wes, I want to say I made a big mind map on like a 4x5 dry erase board, and everything is crossed off. This dirty pig has dirty pig has lipstick on. She looks beautiful. I'm taking her out to dinner. It's great. A
whole bunch of colors of lipstick too.
Right, right. I can erase all this now. This is what a mess. But everything is crossed off. So before we wrap up, let's plug the things that you're involved in addition to Complete Liberty, which I've obviously mentioned a ton of times. We also have this excellent podcast that you do with Kevin Koskela called Healthy Mind, Fit Body that I've become a very big fan of recently.
Indeed. Yeah, that's all about health and nutrition and fitness. And if you need to lose an extra weight, that's a great podcast to listen to. If you just want to maximize your lifestyle in terms of health and fitness, it's a great podcast. We do lots of interviews with various experts in the field, and lately we've been doing a lot of interviews with Paleolithic oriented experts, people that do Paleolithic sort of CrossFit training and natural movement stuff, based on how our genes have been modified through millions of years to respond to certain stressors on our body. So it turns out that, you know, chronic cardio is not really good for us, even though it's been promoted. And it turns out that on the nutrition side, high carb, low fat is not good for us, because none of those things are aligned with what Paleolithic humans ate and did. And that's about 10,000 years ago and a lot longer time ago, up to 2 million years. So
Paleolithic humans, we're talking obviously about a diet that's pretty much based on meat and maybe the occasional berries or nuts or pugs, unfortunately.
Pretty much everything but grains and dairy and legumes, all these things from the advent of modern agriculture.
Right.
And, it, you know, there's a guy we interviewed, Mark Sisson, who says that maybe dairy's okay. It's borderline. We don't know. It's not paleo because they didn't have dairy products back then. But we don't know quite yet if it's detrimental. But, you know, you just pick and choose and do what's optimal for you and what's healthy for you. And that's the important thing. So it's a pretty good balance of discussion of health and fitness.
And as you and Kevin always point out on the show, they did have donuts back then. So,
absolutely.
So donuts are okay. They did. It was great.
Yes.
Raw meat.
As many donuts as humanly possible.
Bugs,
and then some
donuts. Yeah. Well, I
make Homer Simpson very proud.
I got to tell you that I've been, you know, I when we talked last time, we talked was 7 weeks ago, and you definitely piqued my interest in this. I've listened to every show you guys have done since then. I've gone back and listened to some old ones. You really do a good job exploring the mind body connection, bringing Brandon's the six pillars of self esteem into the show as well. And while I can't say that I've adopted the complete paleo lifestyle, I still do have, you know, some dairy and like whey protein, and I'm always on the road. So occasionally I have to do, you know, cottage cheese or string cheese, but really, you know, being active and having worked out for a long time, always thinking that eating a lot of carbs was really important to, you know, maintaining muscle mass. While I can say in the last couple months of taking carbs out, I, you know, have continued to, I was worried about, you know, the energy drain or, but, you know, I've felt great. I've never felt so good. I don't know if I've ever looked better physically, but I've certainly never felt better. And, you know, whatever body fat I had just from having a semi sedentary lifestyle there for a while. I mean, I've always, you know, looked at least while dressed like I was in good shape. But, you know, for a while there, I had gotten pretty lazy. And just in the last 2 months, man, that is gone. And, you know, I mean, feeling like you look fit is obviously important, but feeling like you are fit and having energy is tremendously important. And
yes.
I couldn't be more happy. It's a great show for anybody who's interested in diet or nutrition, or anybody who is interested in even exploring that in the future. I highly
to be integrated beings. Yeah.
So it's like the second podcast, Wes, that you've done that's just had a tremendously positive influence in my life. So thank
cool.
you. Very
really appreciate it, Brett. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
And anything else new, upcoming, worth talking about?
Well, the other one I have is happinesscounseling.com, and I plug that on my show at the tail end to basically promote my counseling sessions that people would like to do if they want to kind of get more oriented towards their subconscious and understand that subconscious continent and integrate all these disowned parts of self and come to terms with self-conflicts and so forth. So I really am a fan of the sentence completion exercises, and that's a tool that I oftentimes use. But yeah, basically just counseling online through Skype. So you can reach me there from that website, happinesscounseling.com. And I'm probably going to be moving to Keene sometime in the dead of winter, if all things go as planned. And, you know, I aim to misbehave, Brett.
Well, good for you. Good for you. And
yeah, I look forward to seeing you there. I think there's going to be a lot of great activism going on in the near future. And I want to be part of it because I think that it's got to happen somewhere. And that's a good, you know, sort of template that we can use to let that sort of meme spread everywhere else. And I'd love to see San Diego have complete liberty, but it's really entrenched in statism in so many ways. And it's just a huge nut to crack. So I think Keene is a much easier process, perhaps, even though it is very difficult. As you say, people have a mindset in New Hampshire, and it's more about the psychology and the emotions. So that's going to be an interesting process for sure.
Yeah, it is helpful to be around like-minded people, regardless of what you come to New Hampshire to do. There has been a lot of things about being out here. I haven't spent much time in Keene, but I've made some really good friends, and I feel like I have a really good support network. You know, those people are here, and I think there's really something for everybody in New Hampshire who's interested in pursuing liberty. I mean, obviously, we would both agree that the ultimate solution is more complex, but this is a really interesting element and exciting option, I think, for a lot of people to move here and be around like-minded people and get active one way or the other.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic to observe and to see the multifaceted aspects of it because, as we've articulated for the last hour or 2 hours, it's really about the psychology and it's about those developmental processes that people went through and they didn't really achieve closure on and they didn't resolve their conflicts. And then they're gravitating to ideas to kind of support them in a false way. So there's a lot of onion peeling that needs to happen there. But I think as a bare minimum, that the nature of this activism is just to get people to understand that we need to respect other people in that we don't hit people and we don't take their stuff. No matter what you call yourself, no matter what kind of costume you wear, no matter if you got a badge or whatever, or a lot of people support you, it's still not moral. And I think that's a good message to send to people in a community because that's the way that they start to understand that self-respect is at the core of all this.
Absolutely. It's really about the message. I think a lot of people look at civil disobedience and they say, are these people trying to convince the police and the city council members? No. The state, the government itself is merely a prop in spreading this message. And while I'm not particularly civil disobedient in my own life, I really cannot afford to be with my work commitments. And you know, I just can't go to jail for 2 days right now. Maybe someday that'll change or my attitude will change about it a little bit. But the purpose of this is not to turn the people in government into voluntarists.
Although that will have to happen at some point. You know, they're going to have to make a transition into the free market. And as soft a landing as we can make for them, the better, you know, the faster we'll all be able to get there. So because it's about dealing with their fears, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And everyone's able to run a video camera, by the way. You don't have to go to jail in this process. I know we did a podcast earlier talking about civil disobedience, but, you know, you can just ask really curious questions to people that are being authoritarian and get it on video camera and show people that this is just a bunch of smoke and mirrors and there really needs to be more authenticity going on.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think, you know, we did kind of ultimately come to the conclusion that civil disobedience in the past for other purposes had not been particularly effective in, you know, pursuing a freer world. But what's going on in New Hampshire is different. Keene is very much a testing ground right now, but I think it's really important to point out that this is one aspect. And like you're talking about, you use the word authenticity. This is a personal quest first. And I hope that we've explored that idea in enough detail today, but I think we did.
Lots of lipstick, indeed. We might even turn that pig into I don't know, a prince or a princess. Or maybe nothing royalty-oriented, just a real genuine person.
I don't know what to say to that, but yes, I hope so. I hope.
I don't know. I mean, the metaphor of the pig thing. What was the pig anyway?
The pig was this swarm of ideas that I had in my mind that I did try to. I tried to record a podcast in the car. That's not part of my skill set. You know, like
multitasking,
right? Like
as you're shaving too.
If I could drive 35. On the interstate, I could probably get it done, but it's just, you know, keeping up with traffic and staying focused, and one or the other is going to suffer, right? Like either the podcast is really going to be right on the money and I'm going to wind up in Rhode Island, or I'm going to get to where I need to go and the podcast is just going to be a completely nonsensical, disjointed mess. So I figured I should just not be moving while I'm doing it. And, you know, I kind of was listening to what I did yesterday, and I'm like, wow, how would I even edit this? So
where do I start? Yeah, right,
so you know, I you were the first person I thought of, and to help get some of this stuff organized, and I think we killed it, man. I think we did great.
Absolutely. You know that they have grease pig races or contests here at the rodeos in Idaho? So they grease a pig up and everybody runs and tries to catch the pig.
Yeah, that sounds dangerous. So, for everybody.
Yeah, it can be dangerous.
And the pig.
But it's quite an ordeal. So at least our pig wasn't, you know, well greased. We were able to subdue it and put the lipstick on it. So
right.
That's a good thing.
A beautiful, non-slippery pig we have made.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right, Wes. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. This certainly will not be the last time that people hear Wes's voice on this show. And I eventually hope to get back on Complete Liberty at some point.
You definitely need to. I actually was thinking about contacting you on this last one. It's actually enough content for 3 different podcasts. So if you want to explore some of that stuff, but yeah, definitely need to get Daniel on back on too, because that was really worthwhile discussion.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's nice too when we're just on Skype and we can't see each other that you know, you get a certain comfort level. Yes, that was definitely a plan of mine to get the 3 of us reunited on this show in the near future, and hopefully on your show eventually.
Sounds great.
All right, Wes, well, thanks again, and take care, everybody.
You're welcome. Take care, everyone.
All right, great.
That's a wrap. You got a lot of content there, Mr.
Yeah, I definitely have 2 shows there. That's sweet. We can dance if we want to. We can leave your plans behind. Cause your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no plans of mine. See, we can go where we want to. Place where they will never find. And we can act like we come from out of this world, leave the real one far behind. We can dance. Oh, we can go when we want to. Night is young and so am I. And we can dress real neat from our hands to our feet and surprise them with a victory cry. Say, we can act if we want to. If we don't, nobody will. And you can act real rude. Remote, and I can act like an imbecile. See, we can dance, we can dance. Everything's out of control. We can dance, we can dance. We're doing it from pole to pole. We can dance. Everybody look at your hands. We can dance, we can dance. Everybody's taking the chance. Safe to dance. Well, it's safe to dance. Yes, it's safe to dance. Down. We
lose it, never gonna lose it. Everything'll work out right. I see, we can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Cause your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. I see, we can dance, we can dance. Everything's out of control. We can dance, we can dance. We're doing it from pole to pole. We can dance, we can dance. Everybody look at your hands. We can dance, we can dance. Everybody's taking a chance. Dance. Who will it save to dance?